Hey, what's going on? It's At The Letters for Wednesday, July 8th. Arden Zwelling with Ben Nicholson-Smith. Our producer, as always, is Christian Ryan. And Ben, don't look now, but in about 15 days, MLB says there will be games being played that are going to count towards the 2020 regular season standings.
Real games in real stadiums. It's
two weeks.
So hard to believe. Yeah.
2 weeks.
It's actually so soon, right? Like, it feels like the Blue Jays just barely got started. Feels like most teams are barely getting started with this. They've played maybe a couple sim games or intra-squad games. And now you look at the calendar and yeah, like you said, it's 2 weeks away from opening day and there's still so much we don't know.
2 weeks. That is so little time. Spring training is usually like 8 weeks, and MLB clubs right now have two with which to prepare for this season, which, by the way, might not happen. We'll see. There is this very weird juxtaposition and contrast right now in the baseball world, where on one side, you've got the natural excitement that any baseball fan experiences when they see ball players actually on the field competing, and we're seeing intra-squad games, and we're seeing Gerrit Cole throw against the Yankees, and we're seeing players, you know, Joey Votto in his Black Lives Matter shirt in the batting cage taking cuts, and that's exciting. And we all like seeing those things because it means baseball's coming and we're having a schedule release and lots of kumbaya coming out of the league, and that's all great. And then on the other side, you have teams delaying practices and training sessions because their COVID testing is not getting turned around fast enough and they don't know who does and does not have the virus. You have players speaking out about not being tested often enough, not getting their results back fast enough, not being given the PPE that they were promised to be given in camps. You have GMs like Mike Rizzo of the Washington Nationals coming out and saying MLB needs to get its stuff together or the entire season is going to be in jeopardy. And GMs are individuals who pick their public words very carefully. They know that what they say is going to resonate across the sport. So when you have individuals like that stepping out and speaking out against the league, you know this is serious. It's a very interesting contrast right now, Ben, when you look at what's going on in baseball.
I just think back to Monday when, you know, the Nationals couldn't train and the Astros couldn't train. And it's just such a weird moment to have both of the defending champions of the leagues completely unable to get ready for the season. And it's not unique to those camps. We've seen similar issues, obviously, with the Blue Jays for different reasons. We've seen similar issues for the Giants, for the Cubs, Cardinals, I believe. And yeah, like you said, it's really unusual for a general manager to criticize the league so openly. Sounds like Mike Rizzo got a slap on the wrist for that one. David Force, for his comments internally to the Athletics, seems to have gotten a similar slap on the wrist for basically criticizing the league's procedures. But let's be honest here. I mean, this is definitely not going according to plan. The league does deserve criticism. They had months and months to get this going. And I know it's a pandemic. I know that it's tough to figure out logistics in a time like this. But to me, it seems like the focus of the league and the Players Association was on the economics of the sport. And it just seemed like the health and safety measures took a back seat to the point that right now here we are, and they don't have some of these logistics in order.
I was searching for like the right GIF to send to somebody the other day in a text message I was talking to about this and about what's going on. And I landed on one from the Simpsons episode where Principal Skinner is trying to cook lunch for Superintendent Chalmers and like his kitchen's on fire and, you know, his mom is crying out for help. And he, you know, Skinner is just like trying to put on this brave face and trying to be like, no, everything's fine. Like everything's great. Nothing is what it seems.
Seymour, the house is on fire.
No, Mother, it's just the Northern Lights.
That's what it feels like. It has been such a like weirdly dysfunctional process to this point. Like over the weekend, the league came out with this grand announcement about how low their test results were, which like really reminded me of the league's announcement during the labor negotiations when they came out and said, you know, hey, Rob Manfred and Tony Clark, they met and everything's settled. We have a deal. We're good. We're moving forward. And we knew then that they didn't have a deal. They actually never agreed to terms. And we know today that those test results that they were championing were incomplete. not all of them had been returned. And about 45 seconds after that announcement, as you alluded to, multiple teams were delaying workouts because they were still waiting on their test results. They weren't sure who had the virus and who didn't. And then what happens on Tuesday? We get a further statement in which MLB cites that 95% of its intake tests have been processed, which, great. You got 95%. That's a high number, but it needs to be 100%. You know what else baseball gets right 95% of the time? Balls and strikes. Like, that is the rate of accuracy for umpires. But that final 5% of bad calls still decide ball games and still affect outcomes. And it's the same thing with testing. Those final five could change everything. You need to have 100% of the tests being processed and turned around and being accurate. Like, we can all give MLB a little bit of rope that, of course, there were going to be some snafus as they tried to get this thing off the ground. And of course, not everything was going to go absolutely perfectly. But if you said that you were going to have masks and PPE in players' lockers, that has to be there. And if you said that everybody was going to be tested thoroughly and rapidly at the beginning of baseball, that had to be there because you knew this day was coming. You knew when July 4th was. You knew the hurdles that you had to clear and what you had to do this safely. And some of these indiscretions are just unforgivable then.
I do think that they could have been prevented. I do think that with each passing day, as these add up, you end up looking at a situation that's going to get harder to really stick to that schedule, which, as you mentioned, MLB very proudly released earlier in the week, and there's excitement around that. But there also has to be some concern that, you know, this schedule is going to be able to be played safely. You look around at some of the headlines in baseball right now, and I thought there was a great tweet from Craig Calcaterra of NBC Sports, who tweeted, "So happy baseball is back and it can take our mind off of everything." And then the corresponding screenshot shows headlines such as "Gallo tests negative following previous positive. Kingery says he's recovered from COVID-19. Lizardo tests positive for COVID-19. Giants suspending workouts." And it just goes on and on with all of these issues tied to getting the game back. And as much as we might like for this to be the kind of reprieve from COVID-19 and the reprieve from labor talks, the reality is, 1.2% of players is still a lot of players. And even beyond that 1.2%, you're starting to hear guys like Mike Trout and Buster Posey express real reservations about playing. And you're seeing guys like Nick Markakis and Felix Hernandez opting out of the season entirely. Ian Desmond. I mean, there are a lot of veteran players right now who are deciding that this just isn't for them, and understandably so.
And we heard throughout that negotiation process over the labor side, Ben, that the health and safety protocols that were being handled in the background, and, don't worry about it. Like, we're close on that. We've got those, almost done. That's almost at the finish line. We heard from players like Sean Doolittle, like Brett Anderson, who would say, "Hey, we're spending a lot of time bickering over finances here, but not as much thought and attention is being given to how we're actually going to pull this thing off safely and to the welfare of the players." And well, that's sort of coming to roost, isn't it? And, we spent a lot of time talking about how player discipline and players abiding by the rules is going to be absolutely crucial to getting the season played. And it's true. Player compliance is huge. But we haven't spent enough time talking about how MLB and its franchises are going to need to comply by those rules as well. They need to hold up their end of the bargain. They need to be testing frequently and rapidly. They need to be providing PPE to each and every player. They need to be cleaning facilities and providing enough space for players to properly distance and to follow the extensive protocols around travel and airplanes and hotels, by the way, because soon all these clubs aren't just going to be based out of the ballparks that they're based out of now, but they're actually going to be traveling around the United States and possibly Canada, opening themselves up to an endless amount of vectors at which the virus could find its way into these bubbles. So, that's just the teams and the league following those protocols is just as important as players not going out to bars and not putting themselves in situations where they could contract the virus. And it's just funny how after this extended labor negotiation in which we saw rather nakedly that a decent number of owners didn't want to play this game out of fear of operating at a loss, and that players were often the ones making the better faith efforts to get baseball played, that we immediately just reverted back to all the scrutiny being on the players here when it comes to health and safety.
Yeah, and they are going to be the ones who have to be the ones on the front lines, right? An owner can stay at home. An owner can stay, even if they are at the ballpark, in an executive suite. The players are the ones who are exposed to a lot of this. And yet, what we're seeing right now, in many ways, is the easy part. Because, as you said, the travel has not yet begun. And when these teams travel, yeah, they will be on private chartered planes, but they are not the exclusive clients of those chartered jets. They go into hotels where they are not the only people who stay at those hotels. They'll be served at restaurants where, of course, other clients and servers are coming into contact with those environments. The risk is going to increase. It's not going to decrease once the season begins and once the travel picks up. And at that point, teams will have to adjust on the fly in so many ways. If there is a positive test, and it happens on the road, for example, that complicates things. If there's a lack of testing or a lack of results, and you know teams are waiting for those on the road, that's a lot harder than it would be if you're, you know, a few miles from your home ballpark. So there are a lot of variables here. I do think, as I kind of look at this and think about the ways that teams are facing this, not to be too nuts and bolts about it, and not to treat this like it's fantasy baseball, because very clearly it's not. But from a competitive standpoint, if we're looking between the lines, the teams that win this year are going to be the teams that stay healthy. I think that's becoming increasingly clear that if you're a GM, a manager, an assistant GM, your priority isn't so much, you know, spin rate or isn't so much launch angle. It's got to be keeping these guys healthy.
That's also part of what I like hate about the discussion around this, though, is that we only focus on the health of the players and we only think about the players testing and, you know, who's positive among the players and who's exposed among the players, when we know it's not just the players. It's coaches, it's support staff, it's everyone who works at the stadium. It's, as you alluded to, the people who work at the hotels and the people who work on the airplanes. Like, it's going to be us, Ben, going down to that ballpark later this week and signing a waiver, by the way, in which we, you know, absolve MLB of any liability if we contract the virus. So there are just a lot of individuals involved in getting this thing off the ground, and MLB knew that those individuals were going to need to be involved and knew that their health and safety needed to be paramount. And it's just been a disappointing 72 hours, you know, from that standpoint. I hope that it gets better, and I hope that they improve and that players start being tested more frequently and that everything starts being taken more seriously, and that turnaround times get better and that they actually invest in further labs than they already are using, which MLB has said they're going to do. Apparently, the lab that they had contracted to turn around these test results wasn't robust enough, and they are looking to now build out that testing infrastructure even more. Hopefully, they can do that quickly, because as we said off the top, 2 weeks until teams start traveling around, 2 weeks until that happens, and really probably less weeks than that, or less time than that, I should say, because teams are going to start playing exhibition games and they're going to have to travel for those, and teams are going to want to travel to wherever they're playing their opener and be there probably a day ahead of that game, so and get a good night's sleep and be as prepared as possible for their opener, wherever that may be. So like, it's going to be wheels up really quickly here, and this health and safety stuff needs to be nailed 100% of the time for any of this to be pulled off. In terms of being wheels up, the Blue Jays do not know where they will be wheels up to after they open the regular season on the road. They do not have a venue for their home games with probably, I don't have in front of me, but probably about 18 to 20 days before they have to play their first home game. That's a problem, Ben. That's a problem for players and staff who don't know where they're going to be. It's a problem for the visiting teams who don't know where they're going to be going and who need to be booking hotels and making accommodations and figuring this out. But if I'm the federal government and I'm the one who has to rubber stamp this, the Blue Jays, we know, want to play in Toronto, want to play at Rogers Center, want to get an exemption from the federal government in order to do that. But if I am watching the way the testing has played out across MLB and I am seeing that the Blue Jays had to leave a number of players back in Dunedin while the rest of the team went to Toronto because of possible exposure to COVID-19, is not making me any more likely to approve the amount of travel required to play the regular season at Rogers Center.
No, it wouldn't. You know, I think that when you're looking at this situation, big, big picture, it's pretty apparent that these concerns are real. It's pretty apparent that they are ongoing. They are not on the brink of disappearing with one more day. And you know, I don't claim to be speaking to any federal cabinet ministers on this, but you just look at it with kind of a common sense lens. And I would think that the last week has not done the Blue Jays a lot of favors as you survey the landscape of Major League Baseball. And then, of course, the situation in Florida continues to be very worrying. So the Blue Jays right now, they've never come out and said, hey, we think there's a guarantee that we're going to be able to come to Toronto. So they've always had that contingency of playing in Dunedin, maybe even Buffalo, as a possibility in their minds. But they wouldn't have moved their camp to Toronto unless they thought there was a pretty reasonable chance they could stay here and play the regular season here. But now, you know, they have to be at least somewhat concerned that that possibly won't actually come to pass and that they will have to adjust on the fly. I mean, I don't claim to know exactly where this goes, Arden, or where it lands, but just looking at it and you see the testing, you see some of these incomplete results, and it wouldn't be very reassuring for the government officials tasked with making that final decision.
And what a mess that would be if the Blue Jays had to go back to Dunedin to play their regular season games after moving everything from Dunedin to Toronto and doing so because they felt it was safer to play in Toronto and they felt everyone felt better about being in Toronto rather than being in Dunedin, Florida, the state of Florida where the daily new case numbers are comparable to the entire continent of Europe combined. Everybody felt better about being in Toronto and now you have to turn everyone around and send them back to Florida where they didn't want to be. That'd be a bad look. But I totally agree with you that, you know, obviously not talking to any ministers, but I can only imagine that they are watching MLB rule this out right now and, you know, having some concern about the health and safety protocols and how effectively the league is testing and just how much risk the country would be opening itself up to by allowing MLB ball players to cross the border freely to play games in Toronto.
And I think in the meantime, there actually is more importance on this idea of leadership. And it's an idea that sometimes I've scoffed at periodically. I mean, I think there are limits in a sport like baseball to how far veteran leadership can go. I don't think you win because of veteran leadership. I think you win because of talent, whether that talent's experienced or whether it's rookie level talent. I mean, it comes down to what you can do between the lines rather than kind of clubhouse chats. But in this case, I actually think that the importance of setting a tone from the club's leadership of following these guidelines, being respectful, being adherent to the rules for the health and safety of the club, for the health and safety of the city, for the team's chances of actually being able to play in Toronto, I think all of that's really important because if you have players who are not taking this seriously, then it will affect the entire group. It's not like if one guy is taking his nutrition not so seriously or if he's not getting enough sleep, well, that's going to affect him and to a small extent the team. In this case, if one person is going to go and break the rules in some way, it really does have the potential of affecting the entire team.
You're so right about that because everything that this organization has said from the top down over the last however many years it's been since Mark Shapiro took over as president has been that culture is incredibly important and values are incredibly important and sticking to what you believe in. You know, in Mark Shapiro's office, there are the quotes all over the walls. And these are the times and these are the moments when that culture and those values come through. And how you respond to this and what type of personal responsibility you're going to apply to this. And that's for every member of the organization. You know, that's for players who obviously are going to need to take their quarantines incredibly seriously and not stray from the Rogers Center footprint. That's for staff as well and coaches and everybody's going to be around the players and around the club and within the bubble on a day-to-day basis. And that's also for the leaders in the organization who are making decisions about where the club's going to play and how they're going to play and how we're going to pull this whole thing off. Like MLB has put its clubs in a pretty tough predicament in saying, look, we're going to try to play Major League Baseball during a raging pandemic, and the vast majority of that is going to operate within the epicenter of that pandemic in the United States. These are hard problems to deal with, and I'm sure that this entire process has kept everybody up all night and has consumed everybody's energy for, you know, most of the day. But you need to nail this stuff. Like, there needs to be some real leadership here and some real values shown throughout this.
Yeah, the big picture challenges here really add up pretty quickly when you think about it. I mean, the Blue Jays do not know where they're going to play. We can't say that often enough. And I think as long as that uncertainty remains, they might want to start looking at sites other than Dunedin. I mean, I think that's what I would be doing if I was in that organization, because you do not want to be playing in Florida. So if you can't play in Toronto, I think you start looking at New Hampshire or Buffalo or some other way to escape the absolute epicenter of the virus. Then beyond that, you have to figure out a way to get your players ready for the season within a couple of weeks. Then you have to keep your staff healthy. That really is the first and foremost priority, is players and staff staying healthy. You have to also figure out a way, as we were talking about last week, to develop your prospects in a pandemic at a time that there's no minor league season, knowing that it might be this year, it might be next year, but these guys are key contributors. They will be needed in the major leagues. So these are all challenges that are pretty significant on their own, and they're all happening at once. So you can bet that, you know, within that organization right now, it's a very busy place to be. Not a lot of answers, but a lot of very, very pressing questions.
And that uncertainty has put the Blue Jays at a real competitive disadvantage here as they're trying to get ready for this season and prepare for a season that's already unique and obscure and strange and challenging in so many different ways. But the organization, the club, like the 60-man player pool, hasn't really been able to be together all working out as a group yet. There was the intake process that they had to go through, and certain individuals had to stay quarantined throughout that, so they weren't able to join the team at that time. And some players were working out individually, and maybe there were some sort of informal group workouts, but nothing that looks like spring training and nothing that looks like a full team getting ready for the season. And then a bunch of players boarded a charter to Toronto, and a bunch of players didn't. It had to stay back in Dunedin, so the team was actually separated. And because of our lack of access to the team this week, Ben, when none of us have been to the ballpark, there haven't been any avails, there haven't been any communications from the team, we don't know if they're all together again or not. We don't know what their workouts have looked like or entailed. We don't know where pitchers are at, or where, you know, what the hitters have been up to, or who's taking reps at what position. We haven't talked to Charlie Montoyo. We are going to talk to him later today on Wednesday. And hopefully there will be some insight to be gleaned there, and just some information that we can get as we continue to try to report on this thing and to bring fans up to speed on what's going on with the team. But right now, all we really know is that there have been workouts at Rogers Center for some players. And we've kind of been left to watch the MLB Network Viz and, you know, some of the videos that the team itself is putting out to kind of identify, okay, so Bo Bichette's there and Hyunjin Ryu's there, but where's this guy and where's that guy? And, oh, well, maybe he was just at the other workout that day and he wasn't on the field at the time that they were recording this. Like, so much is up in the air, but all I am really sure of is that this buildup and this preparation for the season for the Blue Jays has been completely less than ideal. And I think it's putting them at a little bit of a competitive disadvantage heading into the season.
I believe that. I can't see how you could frame it the other way. I mean, I would like to hear the argument that this is somehow helping this team. And I think it would take a lot of creativity to come up with that one, because they've faced a lot of uncertainty. You know, even now they're limited to within that one building. We did see that the roof was open. We know that. Ross Atkins said over the weekend that he wanted the roof to be open so the players can actually get a little bit of sunlight. They can have a little bit of outdoor time to mix in with all those hours in the hotel at the Marriott there at the north end of Rogers Center. But it really is, as you said, a matter of guessing more than it is a matter of observing, because we have not yet been to Rogers Center. The team has really not been forthcoming at all with information or images. So we're kind of piecing together what we know from these tiny little bits of information. And it's funny because the stuff now that we look at, and okay, Vlad's there, he's taking BP, or Bo's there, he's taking some ground balls. That 2-minute clip, I mean, that's the sort of information that we might observe in the first 30 minutes of a spring training workout, like on a, in a regular spring at Dunedin, Florida. That's the sort of information you'd pick up just standing around in the first 30 minutes of being there. And then, of course, you'd have more and more information in the course of the day. You'd observe more things. You'd start to piece little things together, ask questions related to those observations, and then you get somewhere with your story. But in this case, you really are just stuck with those 2-minute clips, and you try to figure out what you've got from the Blue Jays Twitter account, and it feels very much like writing something from behind closed doors, which of course we are.
And we're going to be at the ballpark later this week, and hopefully we'll be able to glean some more there. The Blue Jays are going to start having Zoom calls, we're told, with players later in the week. It should be said that essentially every other franchise in the league has already let reporters in and has already had Zoom calls with players. That's where a lot of these comments about players not really being comfortable with how things are going right now are coming from. And a lot of players who say still aren't sure if this season is even going to happen. That's where these comments are coming from. And we also don't have an idea of how many Blue Jays players have tested positive for COVID-19. We know that some have, but we don't know how many have. And other clubs have released the actual number of positive tests that they have experienced. The Blue Jays have chosen not to do that. I agree that the Blue Jays shouldn't name specific individual players. You know, I think it's a privacy issue, and I think that should be up to the player whether or not he wants that information to be public. But I don't necessarily agree that the club shouldn't be releasing at least a total number of positive tests. I don't understand why that information hasn't been made public. We've seen other teams make that information public, and I don't think that the Blue Jays necessarily need to hold back on that aspect of it.
Yeah, I don't see why you can't say we've had 3 players and 2 staff, for example, test positive. It is interesting. Some players have been really candid around the league. You know, outside of Toronto, you've seen players offer explanations involving their symptoms, involving how they're feeling, what they're doing. We saw the Kansas City Royals issue some really detailed statements from their players. I'm thinking of Scott Kingery's description to reporters of how he felt when he had COVID-19. And man, that reading that, I do like that is such a powerful reminder of how we do not want this. Like, you know, sure, some people maybe asymptomatic or not show a ton of symptoms, but there are still a lot of people who get this virus and still feel, you know, extreme symptoms as Kingery did, and then feel aftershocks of that for weeks on end. So, you know, we have seen some organizations be pretty forthright when it comes to the impact of COVID-19 in very specific ways for specific individuals. In the case of the Jays, we are left guessing or making assumptions. Even with the players who were put on the injured list, we still don't know why Jonathan Davis, Brandon Drury, Hector Perez, and Elvis Luciano are on the injured list. I mean, there's a whole lot of mystery clouding all of this right now. Some of that will probably remain the case. Some of that, of course, should remain the case. As you're saying, we do not need to know exactly which players have this. This is a life-threatening virus. This is far beyond baseball. We don't need to know that. But in other cases, there could be some clarity. And certainly if players want to share, then we'd be open to hearing about their experience on it.
Right. And there are, you know, privacy laws against reporting non-occupational ailments such as that. And I think those need to be respected. But I also think that the players who have chosen to make the information public and to speak openly about it are probably doing a pretty nice service for some of, you know, some people in the United States who maybe aren't taking this as seriously as they need to. You know, I think that if a famous baseball player can talk about their experience with it and, you know, provide themselves as an example of how dangerous this is, this virus that we still don't completely even understand because it is a novel virus, so we're still learning about it. If anybody listened to The Daily, the New York Times podcast on Monday, I believe it was, when they had Donald McNeil on, and he was presenting all this new evidence and findings about the virus that were like mind-blowing. If you haven't even listened to that, go back and listen to it. We are still learning about this virus. Like, we still don't know the long-term effects. Some of the short-term effects are still surprising doctors. You know, there have been young people who have died from this. There have been, you know, people who have suffered strokes from this. So, you know, I think that it definitely helps for the general public to see a professional athlete come out and talk about their experience with this. Look, Nick Markakis opted out after talking to Freddie Freeman. I mean, he was ready to play, and then he spoke to Freddie Freeman, and I believe the quote was, "That opened my eyes." So this is even having an impact on other professional ball players who are seeing what's happening to their colleagues and saying, ooh, like, all right, I'm having second thoughts. All of a sudden, I'm not so sure about this. As we sit here today, we do not know of any Toronto Blue Jays who have opted out. And we've asked Mark Shapiro and Ross Atkins a couple times, and they've said, no, we still don't expect any players or staff to opt out. But I would think it's still possible as camp goes on that across the league, we're going to continue to see some players opt out, particularly as the health and safety stuff has clearly not been what was promised in the operations manual. The thing with the Blue Jays, I guess, is that many of them maybe aren't in a terrific position to opt out, because so many of Blue Jays players are so young in their careers and are in that 0-3 service time window, or, you know, maybe are moving towards arbitration and need that service time and haven't made a ton of money in their careers. They don't, you know, they're not like a David Price or Ryan Zimmerman who have already gotten paid with big contracts and, you know, can take the luxury of forgoing those earnings and forgoing that service time. Like you look at the Los Angeles Dodgers, it's easy for David Price to opt out considering what he's made in his career and where he's at in his career. Not so easy for Mookie Betts, who needs this year's service time to hit free agency after this season. You look at the Blue Jays, not so easy for Ken Giles, who wants to hit free agency and hit the open market and be able to field offers from multiple clubs. We talk about the opt-outs across baseball and whether more of them are coming. You can probably go through every roster and pick out the players who can opt out, are most likely to opt out, and you can pretty easily identify the players who are really incentivized not to opt out just because of where they are in their careers and their contract status.
Yeah, exactly. There are a few key benchmarks to look for. Does a guy have 6 years of service to be a free agent? Does he have 10 years of service to get his full pension? Has he made a lot of money in his career? Is he making, relatively speaking, less money this year? Well, if you've answered yes to three or more of those questions, you found yourself a prime opt-out candidate. And that's what we're seeing, you know, across the league. The Blue Jays, as you said, probably less likely to see that. But even then, I'm not making any assumptions. I mean, there's so many different reasons here that players could opt out. The conditions could worsen. We can't just assume they're going to get better, you know, not to be totally pessimistic, but there are a lot of moving pieces here. The travel hasn't yet started. There's a real possibility that more players will opt out. And just because a player shows up to training camp doesn't mean that he won't experience it for a week and say, this is way less fun. This is just way more nerve-wracking than the baseball that I'm used to playing. And they might decide, the way Felix Hernandez did, to show up as Felix did to Braves camp. And he had every intention of going through with the season when he arrived there. But he made the decision, look, I'm out. I'm not doing this. And so Felix Hernandez isn't playing this year. So, I think that could very easily happen in the next 2 weeks as players start to grapple with, oh, yeah, I am going to have to travel. I am going to have to perform at my best. I may not be able to see my family. I'm experiencing all kinds of health risks on my own. This is, you know, very much a possibility, I think, in the weeks to come.
These are the biggest questions that baseball's facing, the teams are facing, that we are facing. And that's why I think like all of our conversations have to be grounded in them. And I think that's why we spent the, you know, first chunk of this podcast talking about them, because those are the most important things. But if we sort of put our heads in the sand here a little bit and, change gears towards what the Blue Jays might look like on the field this season, do you think we have learned anything over the last week since we last recorded about how the Blue Jays will approach the season from a roster standpoint, from a rotation standpoint, from a style of play standpoint? Have we gleaned anything in the last 7 days?
I'd say some little things. Yeah, you know, last time we spoke, we were talking about the idea of using guys like Julian Merriweather, Thomas Hatch in bullpen roles, and Ross Atkins confirmed on the weekend that they are going to look to do that. So I think that makes tons of sense. I think that's a good call by the Blue Jays to try to get some more relief help from guys who otherwise would have been starting in the minor leagues. And we've also gotten a little bit more insight into Nate Pearson, who we discussed probably in most of our most recent episodes, including the last one. And I think with Nate Pearson, Atkins gave a real non-answer there, which leads me to believe that there's no guarantee here. You know, like the Blue Jays might very well decide to come up with some reason, and I don't think it would be entirely sincere reason, and I think it would have to do with service time, but they might come up with a reason to start Nate Pearson off of the major league roster. And so I won't be surprised either way. I mean, this it's conceivable that they would break camp with him, but Ross Atkins could have easily said, hey, no guarantees here, but we really like Nate Pearson. He's showing us he has major league stuff. We want him to break camp, and it's going to be on him to show us that he belongs in that discussion too. But that's not what Ross Atkins said. He said, you know, we'll see. You know, we haven't made those decisions yet. We want to do what's best for Nate's development.
That's interesting because he could have phrased it that way. I wonder if they want to just keep the pressure off of him and, you know, just kind of like slow play this in the way they would have under, you know, other circumstances where there was perhaps a more convincing reason to hold him down and to keep him off of your roster at the beginning of the year. So maybe they just want to approach it the same way either way and then, you know, start him on the big league roster on July 24th or 25th, whenever it is, and say, yeah, I mean, look, this is our process. We were going to wait until we had all the information and all the health. All you guys were chomping at the bit and jumping to talk about this way before it was time to talk about it. Like, I wonder if that's what's going to happen, because there still, to me, just is not a convincing reason to keep him off of the big league roster other than we would like to have a seventh year of control over him. At that point, though, like, do you not hold him down until whenever the Super 2 is going to be? You know, like what makes one more tantalizing than the other? Like, at the same time, you're just talking about trying to save money at the end of the day. So, you know, I still believe that, like, the best thing for this team and the best thing for Nate Pearson is to have him on the roster at the beginning of the year, because who knows what the CBA rules are going to look at after the next renegotiation. Man, who knows where any of us are going to be in 2027, and you have such a unique opportunity to win this year, and it would be so nakedly obvious what you were doing that would have to invite a grievance. And I wonder if that grievance would have a bit more grounds than Chris Bryant's did, just because of how obvious what you were doing is. I guess we will see. It's still hard for me to find, like, the real compelling, convincing rationale for keeping Nate Pearson off of the 30-man roster.
Yeah, I don't see it, especially as you said, it's a 30-man roster. That's a lot of space, probably carrying 17 pitchers, something like that. So I don't see the baseball reasons. And even in discussing other players, not Pearson, but in discussing other players, Atkins did say that the best developmental place for the likes of Patrick Murphy, Merriweather, Hatch was the major leagues. So you apply that logic to Nate Pearson, and how do you keep him in the majors, or how do you keep him in the minors, I should say, as opposed to with the big league team? We'll see. I mean, teams have come up with all kinds of ways to keep all kinds of prospects down over the years. In some cases, it looks really costly in hindsight. In other cases, and I mean, look, Vlad Jr. is one of these. It looked like service time manipulation at the time. Once he got up here, then we realized he did have more development. Now, arguably, he had to complete that development in the major leagues to really learn the conditioning adjustments and the defensive adjustments that were required of him. But, you know, in hindsight, the Vlad decision does look different. I still think, though, that if they keep Pearson off the roster to start, a 23-year-old pitcher who's already been, you know, in AAA, who's worked at Driveline and worked independently to really make the most of his stuff and be in the best shape he can be, I think if you keep that guy off the major league roster when he's throwing 100 miles an hour, then that does look like service time manipulation.
A lot of eyes are going to be on Vladimir Guerrero Jr. when we finally get access to the ballpark and when we finally get to watch the Blue Jays work out and just see how he's looking both at the plate and in the field. And, you know, in this 60-game season, it does make things somewhat interesting when it comes to Vlad, because, you know, the reasons he was having those scheduled days off last season was because the club wasn't confident in his conditioning and wasn't confident that he was doing everything he needed to prepare and recover from a daily grind of MLB games and prevent injury. So how does a shortened season impact that? Because he would only have to play 60 games in total over the regular season, do you let him go a bit further than you would have over a 162-game schedule? Or because the schedule is so compressed and the Blue Jays have fewer off days built in, and because, you know, there's going to be points in the season where the Blue Jays are, you know, playing like every single day for weeks at a time, do you have to still have those built-in off days for Vladimir Guerrero Jr.? Like, I think that Bo Bichette could play all 60 games this season. I think Kevin Biggio could as well. But I wonder what that games played would look like for Vladimir Guerrero Jr. if he's healthy throughout the entire year, if he could get close to 60, or if he's going to end up somewhere around 50 or 52 with some off days built in there.
And I think some of that would have to come down to how the Blue Jays assess his conditioning right now. I mean, I'm not going to try to do that from the one or two grainy screen grabs
we've seen.
Yeah, I mean, maybe I will try, but I'm not going to do that on this podcast. Like, it's impossible to say. Like, I don't want to speculate on what kind of condition he's in off of those two images. So I think if you're the Jays, you look at his conditioning, you look at whatever metrics they want to use. Is it lateral quickness? Is it body fat percentage? Is it the muscle that he's gained? And you say, okay, he's in this kind of condition. We expect that based on data to take this kind of wear and tear on Vlad. With that in mind, we are going to schedule approximately, you know, one day off every week or one day off every 2 weeks. I think for Vladdy, he's a big guy. He's still adjusting to the grind of a major league season. You know, he got tired last year. He's not playing in 60 games. Like, you have to give him, I think at minimum, you're giving him 4 or 5 days off. Now, is it more than that? Is it 7 days off? Is it 8 days off? That's imaginable. I think that's less than ideal if you're the Blue Jays, but it's certainly better than pushing him too hard and having him break down.
But that also, you would have to think, impacts your ability to win, because Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is still one of your best hitters. I mean, what he has shown in the minor leagues is phenomenal. And even at the age of 20 in the majors with subpar conditioning and being tired, he was still an above average hitter at the highest level of baseball as a 20-year-old, going through the adjustments and the adversity that he was. This is still one of your highest upside guys. And you can look at Zips and Steamer, you know, like, pick your projection mechanism. I would bet you Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is second on the club right behind Bo Bichette in terms of offensive projection. So if you were having to hold him out of your lineup once a week, you are hurting your chances to win in a 60-game season. Also, on the other side of the ball, if Vladimir Guerrero Jr. continues to be statistically the worst third baseman in baseball, you're also hurting your chances to win by having him play third base on the days that he is in the lineup, because in a 60-game season, every ball that gets through the infield, every error at third base, every throw that's wide of first is going to be that much more consequential and that much more impactful on whether you win or not. So if the Blue Jays really hope to compete and contend this season, those little moments are going to matter so much more than they would over the course of 6 months and 162 games. So there's going to be a lot of attention paid to Vladimir Guerrero Jr., what shape he's in, where he's playing, how he's playing, what he looks like as a sophomore in the league, how prepared he is for the challenges that he's going to face this year. Because when you're talking about your best players on the field, and it's a massive fulcrum in how successful your team's going to be or not.
Yeah, they need a lot from Vladdy offensively. And, you know, we had a discussion not long ago about Vladdy versus Bo. And I think if you're looking at the overall performance, including defense, including base running, we both landed on Bo as being the player who is more likely to produce value. But if you're just looking at offense, I mean, I'd pick Vladdy over anyone on this team. I think as an offensive producer, he's the best they have. And you know, I won't be surprised if, even in a 60-game season, I really won't be surprised if he sets a new career high in home runs this year, which was 15 last year. Like, I think he could surpass that even in half the number of games. He's going to be fun to watch, especially at the plate. But there are competing factors there when it comes to long term, when it comes to the defensive pressures that this team is going to face, because, you know, like you said, those little things will be magnified and there will be pressure on Charlie Montoyo that wouldn't otherwise exist, because it's only going to take, what, 33, 34 wins to make the playoffs. So if you have a chance to get one of those 33 wins, you have to take it. You can't afford to mess around. I know there's development to consider and the Jays will be kind of balancing that the entire season. But man, if you're faced with an opportunity to get that 33rd win or that 34th win, you need to go after that.
Zips projects Vladimir Guerrero Jr. for a team-leading 846 OPS. Steamer projects Vladimir Guerrero Jr. for a team-leading 867 OPS. Doesn't project any other Blue Jay for above 800. That's the type of potential that will be in your lineup. And if you have to hold him out once a week, you really are damaging your opportunity to contend this year. I would suggest that, like, that opportunity to contend is a lot more distant and remote than maybe a lot of people will have you believe right now. You know, you look at this 10-team pool that the Blue Jays are in with the AL East and NL East, and you look at their opponents. If you just lined up those 10 teams based on true talent on paper, the Blue Jays are number 8, in my opinion. I think they're better than the Marlins and they're better than the Orioles, but I don't think they're better than any of the other teams in that 10-team pool. So that schedule is going to be a gauntlet. It is going to be tough and challenging, and the Blue Jays are going to have to be locked in and ready to go and playing some pretty crisp baseball from the get-go in this season if they hope to stay in the hunt in the American League. But then you look around the American League, you look at the Central, which should be quite a battle this year with the Twins, Cleveland, and, you know, a White Sox team that some people think could surprise and could be ready to turn the corner. You look at the AL West, where, you know, the Astros have to be the favorites, but the Athletics, I mean, are going to be right there. And Los Angeles has added Anthony Rendon and Shohei Ohtani is back, and that's going to be a good club. People wonder if the Texas Rangers could be ready to surprise in that wild card race. Since none of us really expect the Blue Jays to win the American League East outright, in that wild card race, there are going to be some really tough teams the Blue Jays are going to have to contend with. So they are going to have to be like on point from the get-go if they want to hang around in this American League.
For sure. I would agree that of those 10 teams, the Jays are number 8. I mean, that's pretty crazy because they're not a bad team. I really don't think that. You know, they're a pretty decent team with a lot of offensive upside, some actual starting pitching depth, which is something we would not have been saying this time last year. They're pretty interesting, but there are a lot of good teams. This schedule is going to be a grind. And I almost find it kind of funny when people start to slice the schedule up and they're like, man, this first like 10 games is really hard, or wow, they're going to finish and it's going to be really tough. Well, the whole thing is going to be tough. You're playing the Yankees and Red Sox and Braves and Nationals. Like, this is going to be a really tough year. And at some point, we've said it before, at some point the Jays have to prove themselves and take that leap. We'll see if it can happen this summer.
Yeah, the whole thing's going to be tough, and the Blue Jays do not have the depth of a Tampa Bay Rays or the depth of a Houston Astros. So if Vladimir Guerrero Jr. gets hurt, or if he can't play every day, if Hyunjin Ryu suffers an injury as he has many times in his career, if Matt Shoemaker isn't healthy, well, then you got a problem, because the players who are replacing your frontline guys aren't of the same caliber as some of the teams that, you know, you're contending with and that you are competing with. You alluded to it off the top. We might as well end the podcast on in a similar place. Like, health and depth and not getting sick are going to be such massive factors this season. And those are some of the things that are just like so difficult to project and to predict when it comes to health. And especially with the COVID-19 virus, if we learned anything, it is that it is completely unpredictable, and that anybody who tries to predict it and typically ends up looking pretty foolish. So, you know, clubs really, really, you know, staying on that health and safety stuff and putting themselves in the best position to have as many of their premier players on the field as possible throughout the team. Those are the clubs who are going to do well in this season. And the clubs that suffer injuries or have extended absences because of a mini outbreak or something like that, those are the ones that could fade really quickly.
Absolutely. I mean, it will come down to health and safety, and that's going to determine the winners and losers. And hopefully beyond that, when you just look at bigger picture, hopefully Major League Baseball can get this together and can make sure that the results are arriving quickly and safely, and that the players can be safe and the staff can be safe, and the workers who are making it all happen behind the scenes can be safe as well. There's a lot that happens in the lead up to that, and we all hope to be able to watch baseball and enjoy it, because this entertainment would definitely be welcome. It would be nice if those headlines started shifting so much from where they rightfully should be with all the concern to some of the on-the-field performances and some of the rivalries and some of the distractions that we tend to enjoy most summers and to this point haven't really able to experience in 2020.
We shall see, Ben. We shall see. He's Ben Nicholson Smith. He's on Twitter at B Nicholson Smith. My name's Arden Zwelling. Our producer is Christian Ryan. He's on Twitter at Christian Ryan NS. We'll be talking to you next week, when hopefully we have some cheerier things to talk about with regards to baseball and MLB's return on At the Letters.